Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Today's business leaders are saying that sustainability and diversity metrics are key to the way they do business, but what does that look like in practice? Stick around until the end of this episode to hear more.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we will be hearing from Palestinians in Gaza, the West Bank, and Egypt. First, here are what's in the headlines right now about Rafah. More than 1 million people are sheltering in the southern Gazan city. The Israeli military has initiated a ground incursion there and has seized control of the Gaza side of the Rafah border crossing with Egypt. President Biden said yesterday that the U.S. would not supply Israel with certain weapons if its military invades Rafah. Meanwhile, Hamas accepted a ceasefire proposal that Israel says is, quote, far from its requirements. Israeli officials are saying that the Rafah incursion is a, quote, very limited operation to achieve tactical goals that will put further pressure on Hamas in continued talks. So those are the headlines. But on the ground in Rafah, there are not headlines. There are people. Over the past several days, Ahmed Abu Artima has been sending On Point voice memos from Rafah. He is a father and currently homeless. He has no regular internet, so short messages are the only way he can communicate with us. Ahmed's voice is sometimes hard to hear in the tape you're about to listen to. That's because there is an Israeli military drone flying overhead almost continuously day and night where he is. So I ask, if you can, just put away all the distractions that might draw your attention away for the next few minutes. Lean in and listen as carefully as you can.
Currently, I'm homeless. My apartment was destroyed by the Israeli occupation army. Six of my family members were murdered by the Israeli attack, including my child, Abdullah, 12 years old. The situation in Gaza Strip is horrible. As you listen in the background, the sound of the Israeli drones, which is US made, this horrible voice is continuing in the sky of Rafah and in Gaza Strip in general, without stopping since about 7 months. So imagine the fearing of the people when they are hearing this voice every hour in the day. This is despite that the Israeli army claimed that Rafah is a safe place until now. But even with this claim, the destroying houses are in every street. It's horrible. I don't even find words to describe what we are living. The people here in Gaza are suffering from everything. No electricity, no water, no food. Even if there is some food, no money to buy the food. I'm one of hundreds of thousands of the people in Gaza Strip. Now we are homeless. I'm homeless. Sometimes I may sleep in the school or in the house of one of my friends. The situation is horrible. Even if someone decide to travel across Rafah crossing, the people here pay $5,000 to travel. And sometimes even after they pay this this bribe, they are denied from the Egyptian security. So the situation is still horrible.
Uh,
Hi, Claire. I'm sorry for the delay. I don't have stable access to internet. I'm homeless, without a place to sleep, without a place to stay, without internet, without electricity, without anything. The Israeli invasion to Rafah and control Rafah crossing is making the situation worse and worse. You know, Rafah crossing is the only way for the aids to enter to Gaza, and the only way for the injured people to be evacuated. There is no place, safe place, anywhere in Gaza. Everywhere you can go, there is a danger. We are dying. All of us are dying. Some of us are dying by the Israeli missiles. The others are dying by fear and by hunger and by all the ways. The Israeli invasion of Rafah is making the situation catastrophic.
That's Ahmed Abu Artima in the southern Gazan city of Rafah. He's been sending On Point producer Claire Donnelly voice memos over the past several days. And we should note that drone sound that you heard in the original tape that Ahmed sent us, it was actually so loud we had to put an audio filter on it in order to reduce the drone sound and bring out Ahmed's voice a little bit more so you could actually hear it. So what we just heard just now is still not as loud as what residents and refugees in Rafah are hearing every single day. Now, as Ahmed told us, his 12-year-old son was killed in an Israeli attack. His two other children were injured, and they are now receiving treatment in the United Arab Emirates. Tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians have been killed in Israel's assault on Gaza. Thousands others, tens of thousands of others have fled the violence for other countries, and millions more are facing the daily fight to survive in Gaza. Well, Abir Barukat never left northern Gaza. She has been in Gaza City since the start of the war some 7 months ago, and she joins us now. Abir, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Magna. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us right now what your day-to-day life is like?
Well, it's a very difficult life to lead, actually. We are not living, we are surviving, that's all. From the early dawn until the end of the night, we are trying just to find water, food, fire. It's like pretty much like the ice age or the stone age. This is exactly how I feel. I even now call my children the Croods. In the early morning, we try to get clean water, and then we collect wood. Then we try to prepare breakfast, make the fire. So this is something that used to be only taking 5 minutes in the morning. Now I have to take around 1 hour preparing just a very simple meal. And then the rest of the day is just like that. For me, I try to go to the bazaar, find whatever food I can find. Before that, I even used to collect grass from the lands around me. You can imagine someone like me who is already a renowned, I'm a university lecturer from a good standing family. But right now I live the very difficult and simple life, or maybe you can call it the difficult life of not even farmers, the ancient human being. Mm. Instead of being able to, produce research papers and go to college and teach students, I'm only making fire to cook a simple food, simple meal. Mm.
As you said, Abir, you're a university lecturer and you teach English at the University College of Applied Sciences. Can I just understand? I want to be sure I heard you correctly. You say sometimes you have to collect grass?
Yes, exactly.
For what?
I have collected grass so that I can cook it. This is when the famine was taking a very difficult knot on us in Gaza, when the occupation didn't allow for any kind of aid to enter Gaza. So we food was very scarce at that time. And that's why it was very difficult for us to have, you know, to be able to cook a simple meal. We had to find anything around us in the environment so that we can eat and we can continue to live. Everybody of us has lost at least 10 kilograms. You can imagine everybody looked very slim and skinny. And it was very scary at that time. And as you have mentioned, I have...
Abir, are you there?
I lived in Gaza. I didn't leave. I only had to move from one area to another in order to stay in Gaza and not to go to the south.
Of course, understandably, internet connections are very unstable between the United States and Gaza right now. So listeners, as you're listening along with me, I ask for everyone's patience if the internet goes in and out. We have 1 minute before we must take our first break, Abir. Let me just ask you quickly, does the university, Gaza's University College of Applied Science, does it still physically exist?
Okay. Not completely. As I know, it is partially destroyed. But today, the incursion of this morning is very close to the campus. So I'm not sure if the campus still exists or not. As for the other universities, they are totally destroyed. The campus of the university college is a smaller one compared to other Palestinian universities like Palestine University or the Islamic University.
Abir, what I'm going to do, forgive the interruption, but again, we have to take a break anyway, so hopefully we can get your line a little bit more stabilized over the next minute and a half, so stick with us. Today, we are listening and hearing from the lives of Palestinians in Rafah, in Gaza City. We'll hear from the West Bank as well. There's much more to come. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. In a recent episode, Series CEO Mindy Luber says sustainability has reached a board level.
Look, if you're an agricultural company and you're not thinking about water risk, you're an apparel company, you're not thinking about risk to your cotton crop around the world. If you are a bank and not thinking about stranded assets of fossil fuels, you're not probably doing your due diligence.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
You're back with On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're listening and learning about the daily lives of Palestinians in Gaza. I'm joined today by Abir Barakat. She is a resident in Gaza City. She's a university lecturer in English at Gaza's University College of Applied Sciences. And she has not left Gaza City since the beginning of the war in Gaza. Abir, if I may, earlier when we were listening to Ahmed and his reflections from Rafah, it was that sound of the drone that really, really, really jumped out at me. What does it sound like and feel like where you are in Gaza City? Okay, it looks like we don't have her connect. Oh, Abir, can you hear me?
Yeah, can you repeat?
Okay, I'm going to
repeat the question.
Yes, I will repeat the question one more time. What does it sound like?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Can you
repeat the question?
What does it sound like and feel like where you are in Gaza City?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So right now what we have, this is the, you know, the chance you take with live radio. There's obviously a very, very large digital delay between our studio and Abir in Gaza City. So what we're going to do is while we work on that, we'll continue to work on that. We actually, in the process of producing and researching and preparing this show, our producer, Claire Donnelly, was able to talk to Abir extensively on tape a couple of days ago. And we had that ready in the background just in case our line failed today during the live show, as it clearly has with Abir. So I'm going to turn to that pre-taped interview. And first of all, I had just asked Abir about what does it sound like and feel like in Gaza City. Claire Donnelly, our producer, also asked her that a few days ago, and here's what Abir said.
The sound, I hope you can hear it in the background of this voice note. We have constant buzz, the constant annoying buzz of the drones that never leaves the sky of Gaza. And of course, we hear frequent bombing from time to time. Sometimes it's very difficult and it's very intense. Other times it's a little bit quiet, but we always hear these bombs.
Again, Claire was able to talk to Abir on a day where she had some stable internet. As we've mentioned, she used to teach English at Gaza's University College of Applied Sciences. But since the beginning of the war, she has had to bounce around, staying with friends, relatives, sometimes total strangers, because her own house is no longer an option.
I have evacuated about 11 times, and it was really difficult and painful. I used to live in the Ansar area, in the southern Rimal neighborhood. That area has been targeted frequently by the occupation, and my home has been also raided many times, which is already partially destroyed. So the house is really a big mess, and I don't know if we can live in it again because it needs a lot to be fixed.
Abir has four children, three girls and a boy. Two of her children are college-aged and two are in high school. And like many Gazans, Abir's family has struggled to get food and water. You heard her talking to us live about that in the previous segment. She also told us that packages of food dropped from parachutes or dropped with parachutes that are called humanitarian aid, she says they have not made things any easier.
I consider it as airdropped humiliation, not humanitarian aid, because people run around, try to get it. Some people got hurt from it. And usually, if you are someone who's aggressive, you can fight to get a box of that aid. But for us, we cannot, of course, run around to get from a parachute a box of food, although we were experiencing a huge shortage of food. And it was really very difficult for us. We thought that it would be better for our dignity to die of hunger rather than just to run and fight to get some food.
Last month, Abir told us that Gaza's familial tribes did distribute some food rations, and her family got three parcels of food and two sacks of flour. Now, as we've said, Abir has been in Gaza City since the start of the war. She had no plans to leave Gaza at all. She felt it was her duty as a Palestinian, this is what she told us, to stay in Gaza. But as she told Claire a couple of days ago, her thinking on that has shifted.
So this is just a very fresh news that I'm giving to you today. I took a very difficult step that I have worked on since 4 weeks ago. I sent my two eldest daughters to Egypt. They crossed today. I still have another two children, my eldest son and my youngest daughter, who is in the 10th grade right now. Maybe I would plan for their evacuation later. Maybe I will evacuate with them. I'm not sure yet because we have to pay a huge amount of money to the Egyptian authorities. So, yeah.
So, Abir's experience there, similar to what Ahmed had told us earlier, Ahmed, who's in Rafah, that in order to cross from Rafah into Egypt, it can sometimes cost $5,000 per person. Now, Abir told us that part of what changed her mind about trying to get some of her children out of Gaza was the Israeli army's destruction of Gaza's Al-Shifa hospital back in March. Abir says that whole area is in ruins and no one lives there, and that it's true increasingly throughout Gaza.
When I started thinking about that and, you know, pondering about this situation, we are now left out without any hospitals, schools, universities, colleges. We have nothing. We don't have access to clean water. We don't have access to the internet or electricity. The destruction is everywhere around you. Wherever you spot your eye, wherever you look, you will spot the destruction everywhere. So I started to think, what kind of future would I have here? And not for me, it's for my four children.
Abir told Claire, our producer, again, this was a few days ago, that if her whole family leaves Gaza, it will not be forever. She tells her children that they have a duty to come back and rebuild their country. Throughout the war, Abir says she's been frustrated by the media coverage of Palestinians, particularly by American media coverage. She's also very angry at U.S. leadership.
We are the rightful owners of this land. We have every right in this land, and we have every right to defend ourselves. It really makes me angry when I hear the American president or the American administration at all, or in general, they say Israel has the right to defend itself. Defend itself from whom? Who has the right to defend himself is the rightful owner of this land. So how would someone flip the fact just like that? The majority of the casualties or the dead or the killed or the people who have lost their homes and their businesses, we are civilians. We are not an army. We are not military in any face or shape or whatever.
Abir also says that she struggles to believe what she's experiencing is actually happening because it seems so unreal and so hard sometimes that the daily fight for survival, she's not sure if it's really happening, but it is.
We have seen all kinds of atrocities, something that is beyond the imagination of any human mind. And I keep thinking that I'm in a big Hollywood movie. I even remember every catastrophe movie I have ever watched in my life. And I keep saying to myself, is this real or not? Can you imagine? So please, this is our reality right now. It's not a movie. And we are the victims here. So please stop this genocide now. Stop the mass killing now.
So that's Abir Barakat in Gaza City. This is from a conversation that she had with our producer, Claire Donnelly, a couple of days ago, which we had in reserve in case our live connection to Abir, who's still in Gaza City, dropped or failed, which it has. We will continue to work to get Abir back live. But let me turn now to Leila El-Haddad. She's an award-winning Palestinian author, social activist, policy analyst, and journalist based here in the United States. Professor El-Haddad, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. I wish I could say I was a professor, but I'm not.
Okay, I'm giving
you. Thank you for that honor.
I'm giving you a promotion, I guess. My apologies.
An honorary doctorate.
Yeah, just trying to keep all the plates spinning at the moment. But it's nothing sure. In comparison to what we're hearing and from the people in Gaza who have just been sharing their stories. I mean, how would you describe what you know of what's happening there to an American audience right now, especially since there's all this talk about continued talks about a possible pause or ceasefire. There's the Rafah incursion that the Israeli military started. It's a little difficult to really fathom what is going on there.
Right. I mean, what I've been telling people, and of course, just by way of context, My entire extended family is there, so my uncles and my cousins. I know I was on the show before in the fall talking about them and their experience. I've had one uncle who was successfully managed to get out of Gaza just the day before they shut down the Rafah crossing, but the rest of my uncles and cousins are still there. And one of them, my cousin Hiba, had insisted on remaining in her home in Gaza City just up until a few weeks ago, when in the middle of the night, when the Israeli army reoccupied Gaza City and surrounded just Shifa Hospital. She lives in the Rimal neighborhood nearby where she lived. And 14 Israeli soldiers stormed her home in the middle of the night and forced her and her husband and her disabled in-laws to leave and walk 10 hours down south with just, you know, minimum, just a backpack on their back. And it was an exhausting journey. And they forcibly displaced them, and then they occupied their home and burned everything down. And she, after making that very long, arduous journey to where she was told would be safe, then, of course, she was forcibly evacuated again from Rafah, and she's now in the center of Gaza. So it's just kind of been 7 months of nonstop horror upon horror upon horror. And what I keep saying is everything that sustains life in Gaza has been a target, whether that those are places, institutions of learning or culture, of healing, hospitals, of productivity and growth, like farms. More than half of the trees in all of Gaza have been destroyed, and 90% in the very far north. So it's just been a living nightmare upon a nightmare that people just want to be over with, so they can get back to try to some semblance of normality, to try to rebuild. And even that seems like a very remote possibility right now.
Mm. So when you and your family members hear the Israeli government, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, saying that Israeli military operations will continue in Gaza until Hamas is completely defeated or uprooted, and that is the standard by which they'll measure the success of military actions there. What is your response to that?
I think that we have to understand that Hamas is not the source of the problem, that this started. I mean, first of all, that's an impossible goal to achieve. And I think that it's an excuse, and the Israelis know it. The Israeli leadership knows it. But that this didn't start and end with Hamas. Hamas was not always on the scene. And before it was Hamas, it was, you know, the Palestinian Authority. It was Arafat. And before Arafat in the 1970s, it was the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and so on and so forth. There was a time when Ariel Sharon went into Gaza, not in the 2000s or even the 90s, but long before that, in the 50s and then in the 1970s, and, you know, executed over 1,000 Palestinian men and razed down 2/3 of all the homes in some of the refugee camps and so on, for the same reasons and purposes that they claim today. This idea of constantly thinning the population of Gaza, displacing Palestinians. This week we mark as Palestinians the 76th anniversary of what we refer to as the Nakba, the catastrophe that marks the date of the ethnic cleansing and dispossession of the Palestinians, of course. And that is very, you know, very much on the minds of all of us as we commemorate that this week, because we see this as an ongoing process, what we refer to as the ongoing Nakba right now in Gaza, being repeated yet again, the continued Israeli dispossession of Palestinians of their land and their life and their livelihood and their freedoms.
Mm. You know, a little earlier, we played that tape from Abir, where she very, very clearly has deep criticisms of the U.S. media and, you know, the U.S. political leadership here. Last time you were on the show, Leila, you shared those same views. Has that changed at all? I mean, well, let me put it this way. What was your reaction to President Biden yesterday saying that he was going to cut off some military aid if Israel expands its incursion in Rafah?
Too little, too late. We have been saying for months, and by we, I don't just mean we as Palestinians or Palestinians on the ground who were eyewitnesses to all of this, but also every major human rights organization, even even humanitarian organizations. This is by many opinions the most well-documented, live-streamed genocide in recent history. And yet for 7 months, we have seen our administration, the Biden administration, begin by assisting in manufacturing consent for this genocide, followed by dehumanizing Palestinians, and be complicit in this ongoing genocide by way of financing it, providing weaponry and diplomatic and medical support. So after 7 months for him to come and say, well, you know, don't be bad and go into Rafah, or we may not send some weapons to you, is really just an empty threat. Yeah. And as I said, too little, too late.
So, Leila, first of all, my extreme gratitude in you joining us at the last second here. But stick with us, okay? Because when we come back from our break, hopefully we'll be able to connect with a Palestinian who has left Gaza and just recently got into Egypt. So that's the next voice that we're planning to hear from as we try to understand better what daily life is like right now for Palestinians in Gaza. So more in a moment. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're back with On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are listening to what the daily lives are like for Palestinians in Gaza. And I'm joined today, now, by Asil Moussa, a freelance journalist who recently made it into Egypt from Gaza. Asil, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much. How are you?
I'm fortunate and well. Hold on for just one moment, Asil, because also with us now is Suleiman Khatib, joining us from Ramallah in the West Bank. Suleiman is the co-founder of Combatants for Peace, an Israeli-Palestinian organization committed to nonviolent action. Suleiman, can you hear me? And welcome.
Yes, hi. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. And you have been listening through for most of the show, so I appreciate your patience. I'm going to ask for just a couple more minutes of your patience, because I'm not quite sure how long we have Asil on a line from Egypt. So Asil, you recently were able to get into Egypt from Gaza. Can you tell me about that? When did that happen, and how did it happen?
Okay, actually, evacuating the Gaza Strip is not an easy process. We need to register with a company that's name is Yahala. We pay amount of money, and then we are waiting for our names to be listed and the list that will be allowed to evacuate Gaza to Egypt. So me and my family waited for around 25 days to be allowed to evacuate Gaza. This happened after we were displaced for over 4.5 months. So we made it to Egypt after a time of suffering and so on.
Yeah. And what is your life like now in Egypt?
Life in Egypt while being evacuating your country and your homeland is horrible. Here in Egypt, we are not allowed to work or even to study. We just here waiting for the war to stop, and we are waiting for the ceasefire to return back to our homeland. The the suffering we face in Egypt is not lesser than the suffering we faced when we were in Gaza. We have our relatives and beloved ones in Rafah and over the Gaza Strip. So we are actually facing more suffering and troubles in Egypt.
Mm.
Life here is not easy.
Carol,
as I told you, we are not allowed to work or even study, and we are doing nothing, actually.
Doing nothing. You know, we spoke to other Palestinians who had been able to make it to Egypt over the past several days, and one thing we heard was that many of them were feeling extreme guilt that they weren't in Gaza anymore.
Yes, yes, yes. I feel guilty because I have food now. I feel guilty because I have drinking water now, while my relatives and friends don't have. I feel guilty because I sleep while feeling a little bit safe, while my people in Gaza feel afraid, terrified. And even if I am in another country, I am traumatized with any sound I hear. The sound of the airplanes remind me, with the helicopter reminds me, with the Israeli bombing. Actually, the situation in Egypt for the Palestinians who evacuated Gaza is really tough. When I meet people from Gaza who made it to Egypt, they say we are like dying here. We cannot entertain life. We cannot entertain the safety we are in. We cannot entertain anything we can do in Egypt until the ceasefire is declared.
Well, Asil, hold on for just a second, because Suleiman, again, thank you for your patience. You're in Ramallah in the West Bank. How much has your life changed on a daily basis since the Gazan war began?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Magna, for having me. Do you hear me? Just making sure with that.
Yes, I do hear you. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for having me. Of course, like we can't compare the life in West Bank to the Gaza Strip, as we heard our brothers and sisters, Asila, Abir, and Ahmed. Of course, it's much more the atrocities happening daily in Gaza as we speak. In West Bank, actually, the settler violence has been increased dramatically since October 7, with the presence of the Israeli army and the Israeli system. So the situation become really much more horrible in terms of arresting thousands of people in jails. Hundreds of people has been killed already, and a lot of people were wounded. And also, like the checkpoints, the roadblocks among different Palestinian areas, and specifically in Area C, when we talk about around Jerusalem, Jordan Valley, South Hebron Hills, wherever the settlers exist, there is a lot of violence, and there is no safety of movement around here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, Suleiman, you are yes. co-founder of Combatants for Peace, as I said earlier. And by your own admission, you told us that when you were a teenager yourself, 13, 14, you participated in, you know, what you called an armed struggle and ended up in an Israeli mm-hmm. jail at the age of 14 for 10 years. Is that correct?
Yes.
So now that from that time, though, it seems like the situation has basically been unchanged for the reality for Palestinians. And if anything, it has gotten mm-hmm. dramatically worse. So given your experience as a teenager, can you help mm-hmm. describe to us what you think the young people in Gaza right now, those same teenagers, 12, 13, 14, what do you think their minds are trying to contemplate now, and what path they might head down?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, it's really hard to give advices to teenagers, because one, the teenagers are not the problem. We have to really touch the roots of the problem rather than the teenagers, especially right now with the trauma and the massacre that's happening right now in Gaza. And people, as we heard before, are suffering for their survival. So it's really hard to have an intellectual conversation about what bad they will should do. I do believe that our people deserve life and freedom. And most of our people, if they're given the opportunity, will choose life than death and destruction. And I think this is apply for everybody here living between the river and the sea. And that's what we want to see, the freedom and the collective liberation for the people living here, and justice and accountability. That's what we want to see. And definitely the conversation about armed struggle and nonviolence is a historical conversation. Maybe this is not the time for that. But we've seen this in many other places, like if we take South Africa, for example, and other examples. I believe that the power of nonviolence definitely can take us to a different place and take us to our freedom. Yeah. That's my firm belief from a personal experience. Yeah.
Well, so let me just update listeners a little bit here. It looks like we have Abir Barakat back, so I'm going to go to her in just a moment. But with given that, I want to say thank you so much to Asil Moussa, who is a freelance journalist who recently was able to leave Gaza and is in Egypt. Asil, thank you so much for joining us. And same thing to Leila El-Haddad, award-winning Palestinian author, social activist, policy analyst, and journalist who's U.S.-based right now. Leila, thank you also for coming and joining us at the last minute here. So before I go back to Abir, Suleiman, you said something about living in peace from the river to the sea. Now, of course, that language in particular, many people hear that and hear an equivalence to eradicating Israel, because it's Israel that also lies between the river and the sea. So specifically, what do you mean?
Oh, I first of all, we are talking about liberation and freedom and healing and peace for every human that live between the river to the sea, which include Israelis. I didn't exclude the Israelis in my statement. And of course, talking about peace and liberation and freedom become dangerous for forces of war and forces of darkness that want to, you know, use all the excuses not to touch the roots of this conflict and not to solve it, which I believe it's possible to solve it, actually. And it seems impossible in the middle of this chaos and war and settler violence and so on. But I really know from other historical experiences, and I know from my heart, and from the I grew up here, I know from the people here, and from everything we know, that it is possible, and we can't really drive change without hope. So for me, really having hope in this changing moments, and we can see also, even the U.S., with the students' movement, there is a lot of global awareness right now, and things are changing. So the system is shaking. So the response is by more force and more force. Our call, actually, when we speak about freedom, it doesn't have to come on the account of any other people. I believe every human deserves life, and we protect life, no matter what the background, if it's Jewish or Palestinian. And our peoples in the past has lived together. It's not something new. We can really get inspired from both the history and also get inspired from the future. Also, we have to be also aware of that trauma. So I believe we have to build this together. And one little example, Laila before spoke about the Palestinian Nakba, the catastrophe in 48. We are doing a ceremony for that in the 15th of May, together with our Israeli partners. That could be an imagination thing. We start this a couple of years ago, and we have much more bigger partners right now. So I believe change is possible. That's basically what I'm trying to say.
And as you said, through Combatants for Peace, you're advocating for change through nonviolent means. At this point, you know, what we've been hearing for many months, and especially today on this show, is frankly the daily humiliations that Gazans and also people in the West Bank, but especially Gazans, are feeling. I think Abir had said it so powerfully when she said even the, you know, food being parachuted down upon people feels like a humiliation because they have to fight for the food once it hits the ground. Mm-hmm. I'd like you to describe if you've ever experienced that sense of humiliation, and if and how at all you overcame it, if you did.
Are you asking Asil or myself?
I'm asking you, actually, Suleiman, if I may.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, of course. Part of the occupation policies is actually dehumanizing the people. And that's what happened when they basically, the media machine is basically working so much to dehumanize the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian people. And once you dehumanize people, you easily can basically target them and see them less human than you are, and including a lot of, you know, trauma and not respecting any rights. And of course, personally, I've been in jail for more than 10 years. My brother was in jail. I come from a very local Palestinian family outside of Jerusalem. We're encountering a lot of torture, also physical and psychological torture in jail. I've been in hunger strikes for like 16 days and 17 days, food hunger strikes and so on. I feel in the same time with all this victimhood and all the humiliation, I feel also grounded and strong as an indigenous person to this land. I don't feel acting out of revenge. That's not my heart. Rather than, I think, I feel as Palestinian, the belonging to the land and the place gives me a lot of strength. And my sister named Sumud. Sumud in Arabic means steadfastness, resilience. And that's the culture I'm coming from. And I believe, like what we heard from the speakers before from Gaza, and I know from my personal connections that some people don't want even to leave, despite they might be killed. Mm. With that said, I believe our culture also, the indigenous culture of the area, can provide a lot of also forgiveness and love and healing and reconciliation. I just came back from the Basque country, which we received award because of the genocide that happened there in 1937 in Guernica city, town in the Basque country. Mm-hmm. And I just, like, really, when I was there, I just, we went to the graveyard with 10 people from the survivors and the whole Basque government in Spain. And it reminds us, it's not far away. It's happening right now in Gaza. But also, people, life force is much stronger than this.
We have only about a minute left, Suleiman. Given what the Palestinian people are enduring right now, both in Gaza and in the West Bank, as you described, I imagine that is your message being well received? How are the conversations that you're having with your friends and fellow Palestinians about this?
Mm-hmm. Obviously, I'm not representing a mainstream message. I am proud to be part of this movement. It's Combatants for Peace and other activist groups. In fact, some of our activist friends are going every morning to protect the Palestinian shepherd from the settlers. They're actually calling for a demonstration today, like in 2 hours, against the Israeli government. And they were also dehumanized by their own government and neighbors. So I'm really proud to partner with Israeli alliances, partners that believe in equal rights, believe in humanity, believe in life, believe in freedom for everybody. Mm. And I'm not shy of that. And we get criticized sometimes, of course, which is welcome for me.
Well, yeah. Suleiman Khatib, co-founder of Combatants for Peace, with us today from Ramallah in the West Bank. Thank you so much for joining us, Suleiman.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And over the course of this hour, again, live radio, we also heard from Asil Moussa, a freelance journalist who recently made it to Egypt from Gaza. Leila El Haddad, award-winning Palestinian author, joined us from the U.S. as she's U.S.-based. We also heard from Abir Barakat, university lecturer in English, who's in Gaza City, and Ahmed Abu Artima, who is in Rafah in southern Gaza. My appreciation to all our guests and to you, our listeners, for riding along with us as we navigated some challenging technical difficulties. But that's the reality of communications in wartime. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
So Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Mindy Luber, CEO of Ceres, a nonprofit dedicated to integrating sustainability into businesses. Here's host Kurt Nickisch.
Are the people who are working with ESG data now at companies, are they in a sustainability department? Does this just become part of general strategy or part of finance? How is that evolution happening with the actual people who are looking and working with the numbers?
So with both companies and investors, the cute idea of social responsibility that was at a manager level or something their foundations dealt with, that's gone. It is very clear based on data, based on facts, based on trends, that integrating sustainability into the core business is crucial. I mean, you cannot have a climate goal that says we're going to get to a net zero by 2040 if every department at the enterprise is not working on that. That's your manufacturing people. It's your supply chain people. So we find that there is often a sustainability team, but they're laying out a plan that involves almost every enterprise, every office, every part of a firm. And that's what we're seeing, because nobody can do the kind of cross-organizational work in one little group. It involves the entire team. It involves HR. Who are you hiring? Is DEI being implemented? How is that working? As it relates to where do you get your resources? Are there enough natural resources to make your product? What are the auto companies doing now that they've committed to by 2035, there will be no combustion engine vehicles coming off their assembly line for consumer vehicles? So sustainability is no longer a cute, a niche, a part of something off to the side. It is an integral part of almost every major enterprise and every major investor.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.